Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me and before I'll be a slave. I'll be buried in my grave.
And we're back. This is Radio Free Granada, here every Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. This is your host, Kevin Annett. And freedom, the F word to some people, those in power, those who profit by their attempts to enslave us. We're here every week to not only educate, but to uplift and to organize and to raise up all of the people who think they're in chains right now. Just break the shackles of mental slavery, folks, and the rest follows. We are here to not only do that, but to offer you veterans from the past who have embodied in their life that struggle for freedom. One of them, of course, today is with us for a second time, my good sister from New York City, Coley Clark, who as a young woman, and even from the moment of birth, was struggling for freedom. She was part of the on-the-ground leaders who led the civil rights movement long before the media and Martin Luther King showed up. She was active in Mississippi with Medgar Evers, and all the people who put it on the line and paid the ultimate sacrifice to bring freedom to themselves and to all of us. So it's an honor to have Coley back today. Before we get to that, I wanted to actually share something that's one of the points in our manual for whistleblowers and hellraisers. Again, you can get that at Amazon. One of the four books we put out this year. There's actually a fifth coming this month, the Common Law Manual, which I'll get to in a minute. But one of the points in here under the art and rules of war, let me read this to you. Enemies, like all opposites, are mutually dependent on one another, being part of a greater unity and purpose. And so enemies are defeated not by their abolition, but by their absorption into a greater whole. That's a cool, whole yin-yang way of looking at it, folks. So in other words, you go up to cops, you don't say, we're out to bring you down. We are, in fact, out to deputize you as our servants under common law. We reach out to the people and bring them into our energy. We don't attack them in their energy. We bring them out into our new system that we're creating that's based on our own integrity. That is kind of the jiu-jitsu that we do in any struggle. So it's easy to fall into the trap of hating others, of attacking others, of thinking somebody else is the enemy, when in fact we're part of that greater whole, and we have to bring people, even the ones oppressing us, we bring them out. And it's interesting in that regard, just a note, I always used to say this to my congregations, but when you look at the Greek translation of Jesus' words when he says, love your enemy, he doesn't mean it in the kind of soppy way that is being interpreted in our culture. Just, you know, turn the other cheek and be beaten up by your abuser again. That's the way the system turned it around to make us think. In fact, what he said in the original Greek and Aramaic was, don't be like your enemy. That's what it meant to forgive somebody. Don't be like them. Bring them out of their evil and oppression into our light. And so that's kind of the energy and the spirit in which we do things, and especially establishing common law, especially in the light of all these crimes that are only getting worse all the time, because we are not stepping into our own light and creating our own alternative. We're looking to the system to offer changes that only we and our higher power can provide. All right, that's my little mini sermon for today, folks. But it sets a context in which we're going to have Coley on and talk about this more. Coley is a veteran who has a lot to teach us. A couple of other points. For those in Vancouver this week, there's a fellow appearing in court. I know you... we shun the Crown Courts, but his case has to do with the BC Investment Management Corporation, who have the largest corporation in British Columbia on Canada's West Coast, $24 billion in assets. They, in fact, are a major criminal body that launders money for the mafia that's involved in human trafficking and is systematically stealing people's land from them. Now, one of the guys, Jack English, who's had his land taken, is confronting them in the Vancouver courthouse in the so-called Supreme Court of British Columbia. If you want to show up on Friday the 17th, please come down. It's 9:45 a.m. at the Supreme Court, 800 Smythe Street in Vancouver. And that's a little plug for John, Jack English. Also, we have a little bit of feedback. We have a letter from one of our listeners, Deanna in Kitchener, Ontario, and I've been promising to read this out for all the listeners. She wrote it in a heat of passion last few weeks ago. Anyway, here it is. Quote from Deanna. So it's okay that soldiers from Canada go overseas to mow down cities with bombs and shoot their guns. It's okay that weapons made in London, Ontario are being shipped to Saudi Arabia. And it's okay that no one in this country is being jailed for committing genocide against native people here. But it's not okay for a 27-year-old loser to murder people while praying in a mosque in Montreal. Frankly, why should this 27-year-old loser that murdered people in the mosque be held accountable for what he did? Because the government and the churches are still not accountable for murdering native children in residential schools. Why do the big guys get away with murder, but the small guys don't? I don't see any genuineness in this effing House of Commons. Unquote. Thank you, Deanna from Kitchener. Good one. And I can't resist, we also have a letter from my dad, Bill Annett. Here's what he says. Now, this was in response to the program we did on January 15th, Independence Day, Republic of Canada Day, last January 15th. Dad writes, quote, a great show yesterday. The woman guest, Brenda, is very powerful. But the free bus fare principle gives me pause, and it brings up something we've talked about before. Just what is your ultimate objective? Do you really want to create a new republic? Fortunately, a majority of Canadians seem to favor it. If you do, then you have to face the fact that it will be marred by institutions put in place that you may not approve of. It certainly won't be the paradise that you and your guests envision, with free buses, no income tax, and grimy politicians replaced by the collective voice of the common people, all of them magically imbued with the spirit of Thomas Paine. On the other hand, I sense that you're not talking about the usual old hat kind of republic, but something else. But be realistic. If magically tomorrow 33 million Canadians suddenly stop paying bus fares, defied the Crown and Justin Trudeau and stop paying income tax, it'd be marvelous, except that very surely there wouldn't be any buses. Or perhaps they'd be like a 1945 Chevy Cuban variety, or even hopefully people-drawn rickshaws. Of course, we could do away with income tax, as we managed before 1917, but it would have to be replaced sensibly with other fiscal monetary arrangements. There are some countries, such as Iceland, where other means are developed, enabling the jailing of bankers, but it's a very complex world, this self-management of any right-thinking society. I'll offer another possibility, namely that your super-lefties don't really want to win the ultimate debate because they don't want to govern. They prefer to be permanently in opposition. They'd rather be mad, like the irate clothing customer refusing the haberdasher's offer to make the suit right. Whatever you're doing, I'm with you. After all, blood is thicker than bourbon, and neither of us is taxable. Unquote. Thank you, Dad. That's from Bill Annett across the border. Well, those two letters of feedback, keep bringing them on, folks. republicofcanada@gmail.com, follow our work, itccs.org, and murderbydecree.com. And also in the final, at the end of the show, I'll mention our new book coming out, the 10th book for me. It's a common law training manual, and it will be available through Amazon within a couple of weeks. I'll mention that again at the end of the show. Now, with us, without any further ado, is my sister and good friend, Collie Clark. Hey there, Collie.
Hey, Kevin. Good evening. How are you? How is Canada and everybody there who's fighting for freedom?
Well, it's good. It's good. And how's Harlem doing? How's the weather
Harlem
down there?
Harlem is holding, Kevin.
Is it?
We got a new congressman. This time we have a Dominican congressman, you know, outgoing congressman. We've been there for years. I think he was part Dominican as well, but he's African and Dominican. But we have a brand-new congressman and a brand-new world, and around us new people running for city council. So we'll see.
Yeah.
You know, Harlem has been an exit, and for blacks have been forced out for many years now. So it's no longer black Harlem. Harlem is now white.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of the same force of destruction everywhere. You know, it's an unending battle. And, you know, I've been telling the listeners a little bit about you, but, you know, we had, in the last show, we got up to, when we were talking about your history in the Civil Rights Movement, I think we got up to somewhere around 1964 with the Freedom Democratic Party in Mississippi. I did want to carry on a little bit from there before we get into other stuff, because it's such an amazing history. In the 60s there, when you were, you know, the Civil Rights Movement was engendering all these other movements and teaching people a lot. Do you want to talk a little bit about what it was like, the climate back then, and how the civil rights struggle led you into other political movements?
Yeah, you know, I think we really need to discuss that piece, Kevin. But let us start by saying to your audience that we got to remember that the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is the hallmark of the civil rights movement, along with the Voting Rights Act of 1965, were only two pieces two pieces of legislation required in order to begin to rebuild and recover the African community in the United States, or for that matter, the red community, a brown community, any of the communities that were under U.S. law. I'm not now referring to indigenous nations. I'll come back to that as I talk about civil rights. But, Kevin, there's an unfinished march. Now, we have the unfinished march. We got a Civil Rights Act, we got a Voting Rights Act, but there were at that March on Washington in 63 at which the case was set for civil rights. There were four or five other speakers, one on housing, employment, health care. So these other issues have not been addressed. So as we talk about civil rights, we have to understand that the Johnson administration only took it so far because the civil rights movement went into was immediately assaulted. As soon as it got its first victory, and that was the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We saw the emergence of the Goldwater Campaign and what was called the White Backlash. That is, whites became very angry, particularly Southern and Western whites, very angry that they thought blacks had gotten something nobody else had access to. But in fact, most of the advantages through the Civil Rights Act went to white women and the white working class, not the black folk.
Really?
So if you look at affirmative action, and you can cut in whenever you want, looked at affirmative action, that's primarily more than 26% for white women, less than 1% for black women, around 1%, and less than 3% for black men, about 8% for Latin. So a lot of what we talk about needs to be put into perspective so we'll understand that blacks didn't get a degree of freedom. We're trying to hold on to what's left of the Civil Rights Act because it has been gutted. Affirmative action is, for all practical purposes, dead as of 1990.
Yeah, well, you're talking, too, about when you're talking white backlash, you look at the Bush era, you're looking now at the force of the elected Donald Trump. I mean, you could say almost it's been institutionalized.
Yes. Officially we know from the Nixon, one of Nixon's men, that as of 69, Nixon put in place a program purposely to destroy the black community. It laid it out in such a way that the community would be seen in the eyes of the world as negligent, criminal. They infected the whole community with all kinds of drugs and whatever else, and mass murder of leadership. So we can see that with Nixon.
And the FBI, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so we don't have to ask about that anymore because the evidence is there, and the evidence is coming from the mouth of the animal itself, the agents that worked with Richard Nixon. I say that it begun before Nixon. That's why I go back to 64, 65, and what's called the White Backlash. That's when that first came on. Then when you begin to look at the black community in that hour, it was an angry community. It was a community fighting back. It was tired of being run over by fire trucks. It was tired of being shot and killed by police in the same way in which it is now.
Yep.
So we saw mass rebellions all over the country.
Talk about your life.
The Washington Rebellion of 65.
Talk about your life, Colley, in the 60s. What were you learning? Where were you going from the struggles that you're involved in with Medgar Evers and Fannie Lou Hamer and all those other fine folks?
Well, I had moved on by 63. My first husband and I had gone on into Alabama to set up the Black Belt Alabama Voting Rights Project for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Of course, the film you see is not accurate. First of all, it's 2 years off in terms of the development of a major movement, but it also is inaccurate in terms of much of its details around what happened at Selma.
The film Selma.
We're talking about the film Selma now. And that has become the historic piece that people are looking at.
Mm-hmm.
The Huffington Post did a nice article, included me in it, that looked at, you know, these people who have been left out of this whole dialogue, this discussion on Selma. But Selma, we need to look at the film because it has been set up in such a way that it looks like it's historic reality, historic facts, when in fact it is, if anything, let's put it this way. There are facts within the Selma film. But if you added those facts up across time or looked at them seriously, you would immediately see that they are big lies. I mean, big lies.
Well, you know, for folks who don't know, why was Selma important on the ground? What were you guys achieving?
Well, on the ground in Selma, we were in the seven Black Belt counties. Selma is located in Dallas County. Dallas County had a well-organized voter registration movement that had begun, an organization that had begun in the 1930s. They invited Dr. King in, and the SCLC refused because they thought it was too violent. They asked SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and of course we young folk always went where nobody else would go. We were the super children. We'd go and be catalysts anyway because we considered ourselves catalysts for change. And right. Unlike the King movement, we were not mobilizers. We were organizers. We organized from the ground up.
Talk about that. What do you mean?
So our job to go in and organize these seven what's called black belt counties, which means the majority of population are black folk. And most of that population, more than 90%, are impoverished black folk. So it was those seven black belt counties. Dallas County, which houses Selma, Selma is the county seat, was where our headquarters were. So all of this framing this film around Selma makes it look like the movement was Selma. In fact, it's not.
Much more broader base.
Started in a neighboring county where Jimmie Lee Jackson, who is in the film as a key part of building the dialogue for the film, he is not killed in Dallas. He's shot in Wilcox County, where we take down the first blacks to register in 50 years. Where if people thought Jim Clark at Selma was bad, welcome to Lumney Jenkins, the neighboring county of Wilcox. Totally violent, just almost evil people pouring his mouth.
So, Coley, I had a question. You said the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Dr. King wouldn't come in there because it was too violent. Are you saying...
Yeah, it's too violent. If nobody went to where SNCC would go, but CORE would go to some of our places. But more, for most of the time, it's the student group, the young group that actually starts the Freedom Movement in 1960. Anybody knows anything about the Freedom Movement, knows that Dr. King was at Montgomery in 54, 55. By 57, he's at the SCLC. His group is founded in New Orleans under the leadership of Ella Baker, who will be thrown out because she was a woman. But there's nothing. I mean, there's no activity here. The students take the sit-in movement from February 1, this month, 1960, from Greensboro, North Carolina, to the founding of SNCC at Raleigh in April of 60. And that sit-in movement began to spark it just lit off a fire that obliterated the South and really the nation around the issues of civil rights, around the issues of public accommodations, around the critical issues of interstate commerce. It is that sit-in movement that does that. That is youth. That is the young black folk. Dr. King and his people will move in. They will join us, and they will work with SNCC, closely with SNCC. But they were always trying to control, and there was always this tension between the two because SNCC simply refused to be controlled by anybody.
Right.
Youth
That's
would
brilliant.
Not be controlled.
What do you, so what did you mean when you said you didn't mobilize, you organized? What's the difference?
There's a serious difference. When you organize a community, one, you understand that what the community is, what is its structure, who are its leaders, what are its issues, and how is it oppressed directly by the outside party, called the white folk in this case, but usually the white folk we're talking about are businesses, the white folk that we're talking about are public officials and the police forces. Mm-hmm. Most white folk are just like black folk, trying to figure out how the hell to make a living and how to get on with their lives. But there's also that serious kind of schizophrenia for these same white folk who are trying to get on with their lives, who may beg for bread at your back door one day and may lynch you the next. Because that schizophrenia it exists and it extends from slavery itself. So here you are, we got to organize these communities which may be under direct rule, which means they're plantations. Very few communities that are not plantations are under direct rule, meaning the whites have direct control. Mm-hmm. Most communities in the South, most, will be little small towns or urban centers, or big urban centers, in the case of Memphis or New Orleans or Atlanta, where you have indirect rule, where blacks themselves control the local community through directives from white power structure.
I read
so
once
when you
that,
go in, you got to understand what kind of a community. And most of the communities that we organized in the rural areas were actually, peasant communities, communities with little small towns. And oftentimes we would also go on to white-controlled plantations like Eastern Senator James O. Eastland's plantation.
Yeah, well, I read that on some of these plantations, the black folks there hadn't even ever seen American currency. They didn't even use money. They had their own.
That's correct, and we could document that, in fact, for the Eastland plantation. They would give them some form of paper that they would use. But usually it was just going to the plantation store.
Right.
And there you got your meal, your flour, your corn, your whatever that you needed to survive on, along with your fat pork meat.
Like a company store.
Or whatever you needed. You got it at that at the plantation store.
Yep.
But most plantations, you never left them.
Yep.
You lived on them, you died on them. It's like Robert Taylor Homes, that massive housing complex in Chicago that stretched for 7 miles. Everything you needed was inside Robert Taylor Homes complex. So you had no reason to leave that complex. Plantations are organized in very much that same way.
Well, capitalism's like that. You know, they try to monopolize.
I tried to get on a plantation called Hilltop Acres down in Alabama. Kevin, you wouldn't believe this. I was going to get across the barbed wire fence. I
well,
thought I was smart. I didn't weigh about 120 pounds, so I figured I'd throw myself over. I'd crossed over many a barbed wire fence, but I hadn't looked a shotgun in the face before.
Oh, jeez. Well, look, you
were saying...
Brother
put a shotgun in my face and told me to back off. But
you were talking about organizing.
Plantations are closed communities.
Yeah.
Most communities are open communities, but the black people are still controlled from the outside. For example, you can come to a home in a rural community and begin to talk with somebody about the issues of voter registration. And you look up, and there's the sheriff. And you ask, how can this be? There's not a telephone. Nobody has a telephone. How did the sheriff get here so fast? You can begin to get a little paranoid and think he's following you around, but when actually the black folk who spy for white folk.
Right.
And oftentimes those who don't spy, but out of fear. Yeah. We'll make sure that we get your boy, you run over here and go around quick. Let them know that they've come.
Well, the Aboriginal people do that. You see that all the time in the Native world, kind of ratting people
Kevin,
out on
each
other.
Yeah, we need to talk about that tonight, too. You know, I was concerned about the Obama piece and the looking at his pardoning and how he could not see black and brown and red people in pardoning process. Right. Leonard Peltier has been in this system since 1977.
Well, yeah. Well, listen, before we get into that, I wanted to ask you, you contrasted organizing with mobilizing. So you described the process of organizing on the ground. What's the strategy of mobilizing?
Well, mobilizing is that you got an issue, and you want to get it in the ears of people. It's like we used to say, you want something passed, you tell a woman, and it gets through the whole community. Your issue is well-developed, but you may organize units, but those units are designed for marching, for sit-ins, some form of immediate protest.
Right.
Not for building long-term community.
So tell me about some of the fruit of what you did. Like you organized, what was the results in the long term?
Well, in long term, we still, if you looked at the state of Mississippi and you looked at the electoral community, you'll notice that Mississippi has more black elected officials than all of the other states combined. It's because we organized local leadership. We were not leaders. We were catalysts. The leadership was the people themselves. You want to go in there and pull out from the people their leadership. And if you look at African communities in the United States, you'll understand they're very much like traditional African communities, really. You have like a warrior, elder, sage kind of tradition. And that probably is true also for Native communities. But you'll have that kind of a tradition where you have this elder spokesperson. So no matter how strong a warrior may be, elders generally make the final decision. These communities are based on self-sufficiency. They are based on usually owning one's land, a house, independent of white power structure. And it's these communities that you're really trying to get into, even if they're not, don't own their own themselves, so to speak, they are struggling to figure out a way to do so. So they're easy to get in. They're usually church-centered communities. And by church, now we're not talking about Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. These African tradition is that there is an equality, an equalness among the sacred and the secular. So secular communities are there, and they're there in an equal position. And whatever you do has to come from the people themselves, out of their voices, out of their thinking, out of the way in which they see themselves. And what you're trying to do is help them see a new way of organizing themselves, or a new way of approaching an issue, so that they can struggle with it. And
right.
through consensus, never through vote, through consensus, when everybody understands the issue, everybody understands what the problems were, at that point, decisions are made.
Right.
Because that's a consensus decision. So we're working for that consensus, because, you know, consensus is not always there. You go in and you begin to work with people, and then they begin to understand you're not there to tell them what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You're there to try to draw out from them, from their heads, from their minds, what they really want to do themselves.
Right.
And they will do it once you sit down and begin to work with people, strategize with people, because you're saying to them, you know, you must run this fight.
Right.
You must lead this fight. We are here to help you do what you want to do. And what you really want to do is get new schools. Or what you really want to do is get the right to vote. What you really want to do is have access to the economy, the political economy. You don't want to be always on his friends. You want access. You want access to loans or whatever. So you begin to talk with the community about its critical needs. Now, when I went into Chicago in 64 and saw its condition and met some women from a little school center that was organizing for their children who were being inadequately educated, they were just fighting for basic literacy. But I went to visit one of the projects one evening, and what I uncovered was stench. I came in the door, and there was the stench of urine. That was just stench. I noticed young girls were hanging under the stairwell with fellows. I mean, I saw a picture that scared me half to death. Man, it's true that I grew up, you know, in obviously clearly residential housing, not middle class, but on the fringe of it, but always, you know, we owned everything. We worked as was one family, but there was no such thing as individual money or individual this. Everything in the family was owned by the family. And now I walk into a community where I see chaos and disaster. And you're talking about doing something at the school? So we sat together. I sat with the leadership, a beautiful woman, Carrie Bay. I don't know if she's probably still with us in Chicago, and talked about expanding the project beyond the school. And we talked about organizing this housing project, the oldest housing project in the nation, Jane Addams Home, set up by the Roosevelt administration in the late 1930s. And now it had two kin projects called Robert Brooks and Robert Brooks Extension in a community of 150,000 people along what's called Roosevelt Road, main area of the West Side. But Mayor Daley's first ward. So I go in there, and we began to work together around the critical issues of, you know, why the stench in the hallway? Why all those broken back racks? What is there for girls to do other than hang under these stairwells? And they said, well, there's no centers anywhere in town.
Mm-hmm.
Not in this part of town. There's no Y. There's no girls' club. There's no special girls' program at any church. There was nothing. So obviously we need a girls' center. Well, what about daycare? Same thing. There was no daycare access anywhere. I mean, people kept your baby in the house. Most of these women were on welfare because they could not find daycare for their children, which still remains a critical issue in
mm-hmm.
black and brown communities in the United
yep.
States. You know, so we began to look at the critical issues of a community. I could now identify the issues one by one. And the one that hurt my heart the most was there was a mobile unit called the library that came twice a week. Community of 150,000 people, a mobile unit that came only twice a week. So they had no access even to basic literature or to basic research material. They had access to that, but they knew stuff. They knew about precinct captains and how to work with them. They knew about the welfare department and that the social service agent would show up at your house at 2 o'clock in the morning to see if a black man was there. And if he was there, you were off the welfare. Oh, at that
Sounds
time,
familiar.
They called it up. Aid to
yep.
dependent children. So, I mean, you begin to look at these. And I'm just taking Chicago. I think it's easier to see it from an urban center than it is to see it from the rural, to see how issues you can identify them one by one. You help
yep.
people to identify their issues. So
right.
we identify the issues, and after a riot there in the community, in 1965. I'll go through that one day, but I need to be sitting in Canada to do that one. First time I've been on a ride where I was actually trapped inside it. But black people and Italian people were fighting each other, both of them dirt poor, living on the west side. But the Italians thought that they owned the park, and they didn't want blacks to come in the park. And when some blacks went in to come in the park, they assaulted them, and of course that kicked off the blacks fight back. And the worst police violence I've seen in many, 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 many years of my life. But what happens is that I began then to talk with the brothers who were out there throwing at the buses, throwing at the fire trucks, fighting it out with the police. I mean, really, literally, fighting it out and talking about taking on some gunplay. I met them up in an alley. The brothers belonged to a group called the Vice Lords and the Spanish Cobras. And they were telling me how they were going to do this and do that, blah, 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 blah. And I said, why don't we do a revolutionary thing? Well, this is revolutionary. We all shoot these white folks. I said, whoa, brother, I understand that that this community in which you live is not owned by you. That this community is owned by somebody else. You don't own anything here. You don't own the stores along the street, the buildings, and you pay 20% more for rent, 20% more for old food that comes in, that much of it should have been left in the garbage, but it comes in from the white communities, fresh vegetables. A white community one day comes over a stale vegetable to the black community the next day, but that's the only vegetable you can buy. So 20% more for everything. If you're living outside of the project, you got, you know, houses laden with lead. You got rat infested, roach infested, just began to name it, and poor heat, poor quality heat, especially in the wintertime. Half the time the water's not running. Got all these issues. And you tell me you want to shoot some white folk. Well, that may be nice. I mean, I'm not saying you can't shoot some white folk. However, can we do this some other way? And we've talked about a rent strike. And we got one of the most successful rent strikes. Miss Dr. King's campaign in Chicago. Now, Dr. King was there with a great movement that we must return to, talking about organizing communities into as unions so that all of the issues were under one umbrella. That would have been his only organizing campaign in his lifetime, only visible organizing campaign. Of course, it was a failed campaign. But it had one project in that was quite successful, and that was Mothers on the Move project. That was in the housing, Jane Addams Housing Project. I get a call one morning, it's Dr. King on the line, and of course I was surprised to get the dickens out of my first husband, but he thought I'd done something, I was always doing something right. He stayed on the phone to oversee.
You got a call from DeLord, did you?
Oh yeah, man, hey, and he was on the line. And it was a real pleasant call, you know, it was a pleasant, good morning, Dr. King. I was tickled, it tickled me to death. I didn't know why he was calling. But he said, I have on the line the head of housing and urban development for the U.S. government. And I said, oh, this is unique. I had this back and forth with a nice back and forth piece with the head of housing and urban development, whose name I can't even remember at this moment. But he wanted me to call off the rent strike. Well, now, I knew when I organized the blacks, the vice lords, who were in charge of all the gangs in Chicago. They won the war. And they were standing there with the Spanish Cobras who were saying to me, we lost the war, and we're the two major gangs. And I asked them to do this creative revolution, and they took them to the women, and we worked out a strategy for doing this creative revolution of organizing all three of these housing projects, all federal housing projects. I knew it would be successful. You know why, Kevin?
What?
Everybody was scared of the
game. They were.
It wasn't a help this organizing project, but I understood it would get people off the street, would not get any more killed. One police officer actually shot his own daughter, black cop, out of one of the 10 floors up.
Well, you know, Colley, I just wanted to jump in for a minute because this, when you read the official history of the Chicago movement, it's all focusing on King. And you don't hear any about this, right? You hear about him going to the Vice Lords and the Chicago gangs, trying to get them on board. But folks like you are not
going
even mentioned.
To the Blackstone Rangers.
Yeah.
The kids who are owned by the Vice Lords. See, the Vice Lord owns all the gangs.
Yeah. Yeah.
The lessons I learned in Chicago, including the Lady Vice Lords. No, you don't hear it, Kevin. It's almost impossible to hear it, but I think it's been grossly unfair because the other organized projects.
Yeah.
You don't hear anything about the recent improvement association, what it's doing on the west side. You don't hear about numbers of projects run by preachers, small though they be, in Chicago. When movements come in, that's the danger, and that's why Selma is such a danger. You see it through the eyes of the media. You see it through the eyes of the revisionists who want to write themselves into history in some way which they didn't live in.
Right.
I'm looking at a lot of revisionist history. Some are people very close to me. I love them dearly. But the history is a lie.
Yeah.
Very frankly. So you'll see that. So you won't see this, but Cola has begun to tell her story. I mean, it's not fair to put it off on other folk. I have not talked about Mothers on the Move. You know, there are articles in the press, and that's what haven't dealt with Mothers on the Move.
Right.
It needs to be dealt with. This little project on the west side, that the federal government will have to call us and call off the demands. I mean, when I said to him, I asked him, I said, well, you know, what are you offering here? And he said to me, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, we got 16 demands. He said, we've been meeting all 16. Well, I understood he couldn't meet two of them. He could not put immediately a library in this housing project area. I knew that could not happen. And I also knew that he could not immediately provide the kind of girl center. They could take something. What they did was took apartments in the building and made them daycare centers and girl centers. But, you know, that's inadequate.
Yeah.
But it was a start. It was something. But it was a good piece for the people in that project area because next door was the West Side Organization where the FBI hung out all the time with pressure in the chest of black men. Pressure in the chest of black men.
Cool. I had another question. You know, you talked about when you go into a community and there's all sorts of issues to organize on, not just voting, which is what the official history focuses on all the time. Once folks are organized and they win reforms, how do you keep the movement going? Because people often find, okay, people have a short-term perspective, they win something, and then they all go back to sleep and hand over power to the elected politician or somebody. How do you keep the movements going?
Well, you know, that's the job of the leadership that you have developed. If the leadership has been properly developed, it will, like Mississippi, you'll see the movements are still going. Anywhere SNCC has been in the South, you'll see there's still a movement. People are still pushing forward. Because it was organized from the ground up,
mm-hmm.
and the leadership was local. It was the people themselves.
Right.
But the energy, the financing required to keep permanent catalysts available, also catalyst age. So the setting up of agency where you could have permanent catalysts on the ground is near impossible.
Right.
It's just near impossible. You try to organize, you try to get people off the ground, and you pray and hope that they will keep moving forward. But it's not easy. But if you have structured them so that they recognize what their issues are, you know, you try to help them fundraise or do whatever else, just keep moving around the issues. It's not going to be easy. That's why I like the union idea. Because
mm-hmm.
with the union idea, you're developing a permanent organization on the ground under which is all of the issues, housing, education,
right.
health, all of the issues fits there, including jobs.
And
jobs.
That organization can do training for the next generation, teach them all these things and that. Right?
That's correct. Correct.
Yep.
So it's really, really, but it also can face down the political and legal issues that come in a way in which the average community cannot.
Right.
As just a community. People talk about community policing, but the community is not organized. So how can you get community policing when you don't have the structure in place? What you have is Democratic or Republican party structures in place, and occasionally, an independent party. But for the most part, it's Democratic, Republican structures that are in place, along with the church and
right.
groups of that sort. And there's nothing else really in place.
Cully, I want to ask you another question. What happened after the 60s for you? Where did you go politically? What were you involved in?
Well, Lord, it was over.
Yeah.
I begun the process of leaving my first husband in 67 after I organized Poor Women Against the Vietnam War. I knew that the marriage would not work, so I left him for another man, actually. That lasted for a while. I married a very radical brother, Jack O'Dell.
Oh, Jack, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's my second husband.
That's the one who Jack Kennedy made Martin Luther King threw out of his organization, right?
Yeah, he was thrown out because John Fitzgerald Kennedy, president of the United States, in 63 took Dr. King on a walk on the House, White House lawn and said you will either remove him and I forgot the name of the white brother, one called Stanley Wise, but that's not his
Stanley
name.
Stanley Levinson, yeah.
Yeah, Levinson, yeah. You either remove these two men, I will unleash the forces of the South on you. I'm going to quote again. You will release these two men, whose name I got it, I will unleash the forces of the South on you. And he could do that because who appointed the federal judge? The federal judge that we had to, were faced with at Alabama was appointed by John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Yep.
The federal judge for the 4th Congressional District, Brown, who I love dearly at that hour because he did some great stuff, was appointed by John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Yep.
When he appointed the first black federal judge. So he appointed three judges. One of them was black. But the one in Alabama was real, they were almost nervous about because he was all the, not just racist, but, you know, on the border there.
So yeah, so Kennedy kind of got the radicals out of the civil rights movement, and well, how did that affect your life? I mean, in the 70s.
Oh, I'm leaving. No, but left the movement. Admit now, I had three children. Because when I left the Yacht Club, I had three children. A fourth one on the way. But I was a woman. Women don't get access to assistance from the leadership community. Of the civil rights movement. Men can leave and they'll go with the church and everybody gather around and women tell them how sad they are. And the women come in and say, I'll take care of your children. what do you need? But when a woman leaves a movement or leaves the leadership structure, Jackson said, threw me out the garden. When a woman leaves the garden, there's no place for her to go. She has to now seek her own resources, whether that woman's white or black.
Yep.
She has to now develop her own resources, make her own way. So I went to make my own way. That was very, very difficult. And I do mean very difficult. But remember, I come out of an African-centered community and an African-centered family. So my mother, my father, my eight brothers, and my sister provided me with great assistance.
Yep.
Great assistance. The greatest being with the help with raising three boys. Really, the assistance was raising three boys. So I've spent a good deal of time in New York, but decided that New York was not a place to raise sons. So we returned to Mississippi. I left Fisk University, my first husband, and I left with $3 short on my degree. Decided to go back to college. But now I could not go back to Fisk because I couldn't afford it. And I had to go to Jackson State University and spend an extra year just to get a bachelor's degree. I'm $3 short, but now I've got to spend an extra year, which means I've got two semesters and a whole lot of money I don't have. So trying to, I got food stamps at a point. Never did get, I don't know why I didn't get Medicaid or something. I didn't want to be bothered with welfare, I think. I thought it was kind of stupid. The state was only giving me $120. That's no assistance. So why should I be bugged for that? Bugged with, you know, with social service people coming to your house, bothering you. No, go away. Go away.
Yeah.
So I struggled, Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
I made my own way. I have a battery of talents. I learned that I could use my skill as a poet and speak all over the place. I learned that I could use my skill as a speaker, speak all over the place. I learned that I could organize projects and get a little help for it. And I got involved with blues musicians, and that was really wonderful. The last, Sam Chapman, the old man of the blues, I did his last concert. That was his MC. So what
who
I'm
was
saying
that?
Is,
Who was that, the singer?
Sam Chapman, the old man
yeah.
of the blues.
Hmm.
Talking about these 1890s folk, when the blues was blues.
Yeah,
very blue. But I went with Bobby Rush. A lot of the blues musicians. Just go do MC their work because I had a good voice. I'd go up and do little speeches and, you know, make things look good. But I also spoke on college campuses and moved about. I made a way out of no way. In fact, I once got an award for making a way out of no way because people could clearly see there was no way.
Right. Well, you ran for the U.S. Senate, too, at one point.
Well, that's years later. You know, you come back to another whole world.
Yep.
And that was after the third husband. I left my third husband, very bound man, and moved to Albany, New York in 84. And that opened up another world. Now I'm teaching college. I'm finishing up one of the master's level degree. Started the doctoral degree, but could not keep it because I'm forced into default by the banks and did not get help from the state, who at that time was in charge of the student loans. So I was with those Harvard and Yale kids. The same hour that they were being forced into default, I was forced into default. Right here in New York State, could not get any assistance. I still have that loan, which I can't pay, but not going to pay. Mm-hmm. But so I taught college, and I worked for homeless shelters, again, making a way out of nowhere.
Right.
Finding ways of trying to make the money necessary for the youngest two children, because now I have two younger children that are still in the household. But we made it. We made it. My oldest son decided he'd go to police force, and he's now retired, working on his doctoral degree. My second son is, like his father, a preacher for one. But he's got some triple, double masters or whatever, but he teaches elementary school. And, of course, he's a preacher. And my third son, who I live with, has a Jewish doctorate, and he's a lawyer. And my daughter has several master's degrees and teaching school. So, I mean, the kids made it. It was very difficult for us. But they made it. And I didn't have issues with police violence or gang violence or any of that stuff because I came out of an African-centered family that was very strong. And my kids were brought on along that path.
Good.
Everything in the house belonged to the house, all monies, all whatever. And they
worked
that way.
What are your thoughts today about the situation? You're hopeful?
I'm very hopeful. What I see is with the rise of first Occupy Wall Street, I was very pleased to see those youth because they really defined the political economy in a way in which we could understand where there was a center that we could that people could go to and say, well, look, this is where these people are housed 90% of the time. New York is the headquarters for most of the largest corporations in the world. Mm-hmm. Unless Trump runs them out. But he may close Wall Street. But so that was a beginning because youth began also to see new ways of getting out messages. It was a mobilizing campaign. A mobilizing campaign with Black Lives Matter is the same. But Black Lives Matter has, unlike Occupy Wall Street, a ton of little organizations that are spread up around the country. And they're well organized. The biggest is out of Florida. And those young people are organizing, dealing across the entire state of Florida, organizing black communities, organizing particularly the black young. Mm. I mean, I'm very excited about that because after 50 years of nothing, after 50 years of no legacy being passed by, and I'm as guilty as anybody, the civil rights era to these young people, they do it on their own and in their own way. And they raise broader issues. And they're still out there, but they're mobilizing. They're mobilizing. So trying to set up the Judicial Violence Symposium and other structures that would help them to begin to organize that union or that association, that is what we need. I'm hopeful that these young people will come together, but they're bringing together everybody. And like Dr. King's Poor People campaign, they brought together every group in the country. And I said I would mention the indigenous group before I left, because in the USA in 1968, they shot Dr. King and passed a Native American Civil Rights Act. 1968, they assassinated Dr. King and passed a Native American Civil Rights Act that would have placed these indigenous nations under U.S. structure. The indigenous did fight back, and my understanding is they pretty much have won that. But I think that we have to be clear that two groups were here at the onset. The indigenous had always been here. The Africans were brought in as slaves. And George Washington, speaking to a Continental Congress in 1787, made it plain that the role of the nation, the goal, excuse me, of the nation, would be to destroy the wolf along with the savage being the indigenous population, moving from east to west.
Remember you mentioned that in that interview we did at MNN in New York.
Yeah, we need to talk about that because
yeah.
We cannot separate these two groups. I'm not talking now about the fact that we're in a mix and all of that, my family's loaded. But we need to talk about these two groups at the start of this madness, because right now, as you look at Standing Rock, we are back to the beginning. You see Chicago, Standing Rock, Chicago, Standing Rock. The issues are pretty clear that these two groups need to make sure that they come together and tie themselves together, bring our relationship with Canada back together, our relationship with Central America together. We should be tightly knit, and that does not exclude the Caribbean Islands.
Coley, we've only got 2 minutes left, but I want to ask you,
I want to say happy birthday. What do you mean ask? Well, this is Kevin's birthday. He's trying to dodge it.
Well, I'm 61. Thank you. 2 days ago, actually.
But
thanks,
you're young,
Coley. Thanks for remembering.
Man. Katie, take care of him.
Well, listen, Coley, I want you back on again sometime. Not next week, but we'll have you back on. I want to talk about Standing Rock and how we link up the struggles today. Do you have any final announcements, like about the Judicial Violence Symposium or anything like that?
Right now, I want people to focus on Zimbabwe, Africa. Zimbabwe, East Africa, landlocked, has been under stress from the United States of America, Great Britain, and Western, and their Western allies since its independence, after a 22-year fight against the British. It's a British held area. They won, 1980. And since that time, there has been an embargo.
Right.
They tried to force them to take Monsanto food. They wouldn't take it. For about 2.5 years, they wouldn't take it. They wouldn't. Well, they screamed, they're starving the people, but they would not take that bad food. But now, because they have refused to allow 200 white farmers who were on the land, passed to them through the generations of this colonization of Zimbabwe, won't let them keep that land. In fact, that land has gone back to the people. There is another stress on them and a more tougher embargo than ever, and they're in great peril, and I do mean in great peril.
Okay.
So
Coley, thank
you. Almost 15 million people need our help, and I will send to you and to anybody that needs it the information where they can begin to join that appeal to the United States government to back off.
Thank you. It's been wonderful once again having you on, sharing your wisdom and your history. And we'll have you back. Coley, thank you.
Thank you, Kevin, as always. Next time you're going to talk and I'm going to listen.
We'll do it again. Thank you, sister.
Love you. Love you, Katie. Love you, brother.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye for now. Coley Clark, one of our veterans, one of our ancestors. Next week, we'll be back here, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Central. Follow our work, itccs.org, murderbydecree.com. Write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. Final announcement, our new common law training manual will be out from CreateSpace and Amazon over the next couple of weeks. Keep an eye for that. If you want copies, just write to us. We will send them on. Until next week, sisters and brothers, stay strong, stay clear. Bye for now.
Paul and Silas, bound in jail, had no money for to go to bail. Keep your eyes on the prize.